A new relationship would be based upon the human rights of all Aboriginal people, instead of the proposed programs and policy changes that once again leave Aboriginal women marginalized and without an equal voice. When the elimination of gendered racism derives from systemic and institutionalized racism must be addressed. There are some statistics that occur and that have not been included and are part of the reality of Aboriginal women, that we see 3/4 of Indigenous women have been victims of family violence. Indigenous women have higher rates of poverty. 68% of children under the age of 15 are living with single parents, and those single parents, the majority of them, are women. 40% of women leave for the city to escape situation of family violence. Therefore, more must be done to support Aboriginal women. Housing issues affect Aboriginal women at the most basic human level, and affects their safety, health, and well-being. And more needs to be done to support Native women's shelters. Aboriginal women face twice the poverty that most non-Aboriginal women live through. And so what we're here today is to say that we cannot progress unless the true issues that have been plaguing our people are dealt with properly. And oppression, abuse, these are all the issues that have plagued all Aboriginal people. Women are the central part of the family structures and the social structures. We are the most marginalized in Canada, and until we can properly have support and resources to address these issues, nothing will change for the future of Aboriginal people.
What do you feel about the National Women's Association is attending the conference coming up?
Because it's the first time that a Native women's organization has been invited to sit at a ministerial discussions, and it's important because Native women's perspectives have been forgotten for so many years, that it's important that they emphasize our realities and try and implement our realities and perspectives in these discussions, although they also feel the same way that Quebec Native women does, and that they disagree with how the process has evolved and are not happy with what they've seen of the documents that have not included Aboriginal people's perspectives.
It seems dangerous to me to Indigenous sovereignty, to Mohawk sovereignty, to First Nation sovereignty, to be engaging in these kinds of decisions, like the First Nations Governments Agreement, mm-hmm. Which basically take Indigenous communities off of the Indian Act, but municipalize them, like they tried doing the Gansadage, Bill S-24. These bills that try to say that Indigenous communities are part of the Canadian state. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that these other chiefs are interested in aren't afraid of signing onto these agreements?
Across the country, there's a wide, I guess, diversity of what people feel and think and what they'll settle for. Especially out west, there is a lot of treaty one up to treaty eight, which had different stipulations in them. But the bottom line comes down to it is a lot of people are in such desperate measures in that their communities are in such disarray that they feel that this is one of the only solutions they have at this point in time, is to take a leap of faith or a leap of hope and move forward in this direction, which again is contrary to Aboriginal sovereignty, but they feel it's desperate times in many communities, and so they have their backs against the wall.
That would take away the power and authority of Aboriginal people and our rights to our territories, so it's in their interest as well in the provinces to put us under their control and jurisdiction rather than what's been going on in the past, which is federal, which is where we should be at and dealing on a nation-to-nation basis, and this would cut us down from that.
But why do you think Phil Fontaine and the other chiefs are interested in participating in this process?
From my personal point of view, I see that Phil Fontaine has really pushed the government of Canada's agenda and has not really pushed the needs and the realities of Aboriginal people. He's really ignored the wishes and the perspectives of the Aboriginal people who were consulted, which was very little. But at the same time, I think he's really like another level of the Department of Indian Affairs and the patriarchal attitude that they have towards us. And it's a shame to see that, because it's like, you know, we have our own government agent, which is basically what's happening. And this is the process that it should have been done on an equal basis. It shouldn't be up to one person who acts like he's the Prime Minister of Aboriginal people to decide for all of us what will be the outcomes of the discussions. So.
You had mentioned in the press conference the notion of a pan.
Well, what's being called is the pan Aboriginal. Okay. That's the term. That's the phrase of the week.
Is there a pan Aboriginal movement that could provide this kind of support instead of going to the AFN or signing onto these new agreements?
Well, there are several. Issues that are very similar across the country, but what it comes down to is each individual, even down to a community or a region, has its own way of dealing with those. You know, so to say any type of maybe have a principle-based approach, which people follow, but how you're going to actually carry it out in your area is a whole different story. Rather than saying everybody here, you know, you get the whole book from page 1 to 100 and tells you this is how you do it, and it certainly will not work. People in larger communities, smaller communities, northern communities, urban communities, suburban communities, rural communities. I mean, it's all different.
Flexible as an ancient tree, so I can stand up tall in the wind and the water. I am all alone here in a luna bella, hides behind the clouds, darkness of night time, I just fear to push my voice down beyond the outline. Sadness lies in buckling shame. Shame from moments I have head tripped, the ones I love most, but I'm mending now towards the peaceful exit of that ghost. I'm mending now towards peaceful exit of that ghost. I'm mending. I wish I were as strong and as flexible as an ancient tree, so I could stand up tall, feeling the wind and the water in me, the water in me, the water in me, water in me.
How do you feel about the finally releasing of funds for the Sisters in Spirit campaign?
We're very, very happy that finally that the funds have been released. It's a far cry from what we had asked, and to truly address the issues of violence against Aboriginal women at the various levels. But I think that it's a good start. It's definitely not the final, but it's a good start, and I guess it was good to see that some kind of progress was on that level. It took a long time for it to happen. Canada announced at the United Nations in New York in May that they were giving the Native Women's Association of Canada funding for the Sisters in Spirit, and it's taken until, you know, this week for the funding to finally arrive. So that just says a lot about their bureaucracy. We're working on various levels, issues of matrimonial property, the status, in the sexual discrimination under the Indian Act that Aboriginal women face, violence against women.
Would you be interested in speaking at all a bit about the total lack of legislation pertaining to protecting Native women, about the total lack of any kind of discussion at the forthcoming ministers' conference?
Well, this is all about colonization, right? This is all about how they disguise certain changes in legislation to seem like there's some kind of equality. I guess the actions so far have been insufficient to support the activities of organizations like Aboriginal women's organizations in combating violence at the levels of the government. You know, they see it as a domestic issue that maybe, a minister in the Quebec cabinet said, well, it's a cultural thing, so they have to deal with it themselves. And it's really not. It's really something that colonization and oppression has done to our people. So at that level, we have to sensitize our own people. And it requires resources, it requires time. But we've also asked for sensitization of judges, of lawyers, of providing better training and resources for police officers on reserves and off reserve, like in RCMP or Sûreté du Québec. Because the issue is getting worse. It's not getting better. And it's only through organizations like Quebec Native Women or the Native Women's Association of Canada that keep pushing this that any kind of movement will happen. But we still are knocking on the doors. We're still having them slammed in our face in a sense in respect to the inaction. I mean, they do listen to us, but there's not enough being done. There's hundreds of miles still yet to go in regards to seeing any kind of substantial support by different government agencies in regards to these issues. If they keep our communities unhealthy, then it's to their advantage, because then we still are becoming in a sense, they might not agree to this statement, but we're a sovereign, dependent state. You know, as long as we remain unhealthy, things will not change. And then they're going to put in a whole bunch of money and then tell the Canadian public, well, we tried. We tried to help them, but they couldn't. And, you know, that's why we keep saying, unless these issues are profoundly addressed, we'll continue to suffer. We'll continue to see poverty in our communities, and those children are our future. We cannot accept it. That's why I think it's a courageous act by both organizations, Quebec Native Women and the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador, to boycott this whole process, because it's in a sense not so much a show, but it is in a respect to say that, look, we're trying to have a new relationship with Aboriginal people, but they don't want it. They don't want to be our friends, right? But we're saying a new relationship is based on honesty and respect, and that's very little to ask for in this day and age in regards to one of the most well-known leaders of human rights in the world, which is Canada.
Well, and it also does seem dangerous, because oftentimes Canada will hold meetings like this and say it was a consultation process, mm-hmm. and say, well, we consulted, it's fine, you know, everything is okay. Do you see a way outside of dealing with Canada, outside of dealing with colonial governments, to address the issues of violence to Aboriginal women, to address the needs of residential schools, to address these issues without
dealing with these governments?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the answer will definitely come from Aboriginal people themselves. That's one of the efforts that we're trying to do is to have more Aboriginal men involved in this, and to say this is not acceptable anymore to have women and children be victims of violence. It just goes along with perpetuating the effects of residential school, the effects of colonization. So really, what we've been saying is that this has to come in a holistic manner. It has to come with our traditional medicines that can be you know, in conjunction with Western medicine. But it really has to be done based upon our cultural values and our identity and enforcing the language. I mean, language is one of the key components of reinforcing and strengthening identity. And even then, the funding for that is piecemeal. So I think if we keep looking to the government for the answers, we will never get anywhere. We really have to look within ourselves, in our communities, and start initiating those processes that deal with the problems that we face.